pour yourself a cup of tea, put your feet up, and relax. Show host Randy Fine, narcissistic abuse expert, compassionate counselor for clients worldwide, and author of the groundbreaking new book, Close Encounters of the Worst Kind, invites you into her sanctuary, a place where your emotional, physical, and spiritual well-being are all that matters. Time to Heal is a fundraising single written and performed by Johnny Z for the Amy Winehouse Foundation. For more information, please go to johnnymusic.com, johnnymusic.com. And now, it's time to meet Randy, show host of the podcast enjoyed by fans around the globe, A Fine Time for Healing.
Good morning. Thank you for tuning in to listen to A Fine Time for Healing. I am your talk show host, Randy Fine. Are you battling perfectionism? Did you know that perfectionism is a hidden epidemic in our culture? Well, today's special guest, Dr. Margaret Robinson Rutherford, a psychologist in private practice for over 25 years, explains, perfectionism is a critical aspect of depression that gets far too little attention these days. It is common knowledge that we live in a social media-driven society where everyone is trying to just post the highlight reel of their lives as opposed to the messy truth. This emphasis on perfection, especially in the social media world, is leading to an uptick in depression and anxiety. The emotional battles which ensue are also known to result in suicide. And for many of the people afflicted, there seems to be no reason. They seemed happy, engaged in life, successful, well-liked. In Dr. Rutherford's new book, Perfectly Hidden Depression, How to Break Free from the Perfectionism That Makes Your Depression masks your depression, she offers a comprehensive healing pathway out of this secret hell. She uses her life experiences along with the stories of others who've identified with this overlooked presentation of depression to gently but assertively move the reader toward a life no longer governed by inflexible beliefs, but lived with increased freedom and true joy. This is going to be a very interesting show, and it's going to wake up many of you. If not, if you haven't experienced this yourself, then you may know someone who is. So let me introduce you to my special guest so we can get started. Good morning, Dr. Rutherford. Welcome.
Morning, Randy, and please call me Margaret. That's just great.
Perfect.
I will tell you that I've had a lot of people reach out to me who are watching friends or watching their partners go through the motions like this, and they will have experienced a loss or a death, and they don't cry, or something challenging happens, and they just buckle down harder and don't express any kind of emotion around it. And that's a huge clue that something like this may be going on. So thank you for having me, and I hope that everybody wakes up out there.
I hope so,
and,
too. I hope so, too, because,
yeah.
You know, right, I mean, you're passionate about this, and you want mental health for everybody, because for the most part it's accessible, and we don't have to feel the way we do. So your book is called Perfectly Hidden Depression, How to Break Free from the Perfectionism That Masks Your Depression. Okay, so how would you explain perfectly hidden depression?
Sure. You know, Randy, I've been blogging for about, a little over seven years now, and then I started DrMargaretRutherford.com, where I would talk more about mental health stuff. I was actually talking about empty nest when I first started writing. And I just was in my sunroom one day and was writing a post and thought about some of the people that I had seen through the years, people that we had discovered were depressed, but their treatment pathway had been very different and they presented very differently. These were people who would tell me about really difficult things in their lives, like perhaps being raped or having a tornado go through their house or being bullied as children, or even by their parents, and they would just have no emotional connection to anything like that. I would call it trauma or pain, and they'd kind of look at me like, well, you know, that tornado hit a lot of other people's homes, or, you know, my rape happened once. I wasn't sexually abused over and over again. So they would discount and deny this kind of thing and then not be able to express in the moment any kind of connection to pain. So I wrote about these people, and I called it the perfectly hidden depressed person. Are you one? It was just a term that I picked out of the air and made sense to me. And at that time, my blog posts were getting, 50 shares, something like that. It's a little blogger from Arkansas. Well, it went viral, and I was writing for the Huffington Post at the time as well, and I sent it into them, and they published it, and I had forgotten that I had my email at the bottom of the post. Well, here came hundreds of emails. This is me. How did you figure this out? What is this? We've never seen anything like this. And so I began wondering myself, you know, has nobody talked about this? And of course they had. Perfectionism has been known certainly by the psychology profession and the psychiatric profession that it can be a problem, but it's more of a character trait. It's not considered a symptom of depression, because it's not. Over the years, what I did was I looked at whatever kinds of popular books or research was happening between the connection between perfectionism and depression. And of course, found Dr. Brené Brown's work, which was incredible. For some, I think I'd been living under a rock that I didn't even know about her. And so I read her work, but she doesn't make the connection. She stops at the importance of vulnerability and the power of that, which is incredible. It's a lot of what I talk about as well. But she doesn't go so far as to say, and it can be actual depression underneath. So the perfectionism acts to mask, to cloak, to hide, to cover, and the shame that goes along with this kind of perfectionism. It's a constant inner voice of shame that won't allow you to ever consider your own emotional losses or emotional pain or emotional trauma, and you've hidden it for so many years that sometimes it actually becomes almost unconscious that you're doing so.
That must be extraordinarily painful, but so many people walk around with happy faces because they don't want to feel that pain. And what you said about, it not being recognized, it really does take an out-of-the-box professional thinker, to be able to pick these kind of things out that aren't traditional. So what are the characteristics of perfectly hidden depression?
You know, Randy, you just brought up such an important point, because over the years, what people did, they would contact me. I asked at the bottom of many posts on the topic, if you'd be interested in being interviewed, if you identify with this, let me know. And I probably conducted, I would say around 90 people in about a 12-month period of time contacted me, and I culled through some of those, because some of them were not people that really weren't appropriate. But what they told me, several of them had gone to practitioners and said, I don't know what's wrong, but something's wrong. Well, you start clicking off what are the classic symptoms of depression, depressed mood. They won't someone with perfectly hidden depression won't tell you they're depressed. They don't think they're depressed. Anhedonia, which is another huge symptom of depression, which is a lack of pleasure in previously pleasurable activities. That's not present either. They certainly, you know, are engaged in life, very productive, you know, head of, they're coaches of soccer teams, they're heads of corporations, they're, you know, they're volunteer chair people, you know, they are leaders. So they're highly engaged. So what is so tragic is that these people, if they look for help, which often shame won't allow them to do that, but if they look for help, they will be told they're anxious, or they'll be told, as I said in the beginning of our conversation, they're worried or they're overworked. And so they leave feeling so ashamed of even having asked. But so what I decided to do was take it out of the diagnostic categories entirely, because I'm certainly not narcissistic enough to believe that I've come up with some sort of, you know, complete different diagnosis for depression. And I call it a syndrome. And what a syndrome is, it's a well-known syndrome is codependence. You know, codependence wasn't a thing until there were a whole lot of people gathered around someone's living room, and they were all in relationship with people with alcoholism, and they all realized that they did certain things or believed certain things that were very similar to one another. They had this group of factors that would identify them as codependent. So, and that's a syndrome. So I think of perfectly hidden depression as a syndrome as well. And there are basically 10 interactive factors. There's one I've already talked about, with perfectionism, with a very strong voice of shame that fuels it, not just need for accomplishment, but shame. These people are incredibly over-responsible. They worry. They avoid being out of control or feeling out of control. They discount or deny any kind of painful things that have happened to them. They're a really sincerely good friend, but they don't let anybody into their inner world. They don't know how to express painful emotion. They can describe it to you. They can say, gosh, my dog died last week and I'm really sad about it. But can they connect with it in front of other people? No. Sometimes not even with themselves. They're huge believers in counting their blessings as the way you should live your life, which means you never want to look at a more, you know, maybe some of us have friends that are extremely attractive, culturally attractive. And, you know, that friend will say to you, I go somewhere, and if someone is nice to me or seems interested in me, I don't know if it's only because of my looks or because they're interested in me. I mean, that's a downside of being someone who is culturally attractive. So that's what I'm saying. But these people with perfectly hidden depression would say, oh, but you're attractive. That's all you should focus on. And then they also, to feel good about themselves, they have to do tasks. It's what they have accomplished is who they are, not necessarily what they've meant to people or, but what have you done for me lately kind of thing. And the last one is something that is really, I just wanted to put it in there because I do think that a lot of people who probably would identify with perfectly hidden depression might also have a co-occurring anxiety disorder or some kind of disorder having to do with control issues. It could be addiction, be an eating disorder. It could be an actual anxiety disorder of some kind. And, of course, there is depression as well, but that's, like we've said, hidden. So that's what I came up with.
Okay. Well, that that certainly is a very well put together sort of diagnosis, if you will. Yeah,
well, no, it's not
thing.
A diagnosis. That's what's important to remember. Yeah, because it's more something people would say, that's me, but
you can't,
you know,
diagnose
the diagnostic
that,
criteria
right.
there. Yeah, right. It's not.
I gotcha.
Sort of. Yeah, okay.
Right.
Okay.
So, right, identification. Let's just use the word identification, huh? Since it's not, it
there
cannot
you go.
Be diagnosed. Okay, great. Yeah, there, you know, it was so funny when you said, not funny, but ironic when you said, you know, that attractive people, people won't accept the fact that they're depressed. And I had a narcissistic mother, and she, whenever I was depressed as a teenager, I was often depressed, she would say to me, "You're beautiful. What do you have to be depressed about?" And it was very hard
yes,
to hear that.
Exactly.
It's very hard to hear that because it's not acknowledging how you feel. And it's a sort of objectification. So,
exactly.
You know what I'm saying?
Yes, I
so,
do.
Yeah.
So, I'm sorry you went through that. That is pretty superficially led parenting, so I'm sorry you went through that.
Oh, that's just the tip of the iceberg, but
okay.
I've healed, and it's why I do the work that I do. So
good.
After
good.
Experience a child, yeah, I made lemonade out of lemons.
Good for you.
So, yeah. So typically depressed people are sad and they have no energy, and so So are these people underlying this facade or this perfectionism or whatever they're doing to hide it, are they sad? Or is it just that they can't get in touch with that feeling?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Interesting distinction, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I think that, you know, I count it a lot on these interviews and my own patients who started coming in because I was writing about this, and they would walk in the door and say, "I read this, you know, that you had written, and this is me." And so I learned so much from them. And what they say is that there is an awareness. Well, you know what, before I say this, let me make one more other distinction. There is a concept out there called smiling depression or high-functioning depression. And you will see it written about in places like The Mighty and some other places, which is a great website if your listeners don't know about it. But and that is – that certainly people who experience that or are living their life like that, that they know they do actually – know that they fit into the rubric of depression. They know they're melancholy. They know they didn't sleep at all last night, or they wanted to sleep and they couldn't get up this morning. They know that, you know, all these things are going on, and they still walk out of the door and put a smile on their face.
Are these the kind of people who are, you know, who keep busy because when they're quiet, when they sit quiet, that's when it overtakes them and they don't like that feeling?
Yes, I think so. The interesting thing is that what can happen is that my belief is that a lot of this perfectionism and this kind of perfectionistic strategy gets started very, very early. And so it's more than, or it's different from, the kind of smiling depression where you know you actually do fit the criteria. You know that you have these, if we got out the symptoms of depression, that you would fall within them, that you feel hopeless and helpless and all that stuff. The person I'm really trying to reach is the person who all of that has become unconscious because it's been going on for so long. Mm-hmm. You take the child who had an alcoholic mother or a mother with a personality disorder, and she had to basically not only raise herself, but raise her siblings. Or you take a child his father who threw rocks at him and says, "You're never going to amount to anything." And so he became this bigger than life you know, I can be better than anybody at anything kind of person. You take someone who grew up in a family where if you started to cry, you were told that that was weak and that was wrong and stop it. And you should believe in God more. You should, you know, we Robinsons don't do that. I mean, whatever you were told, you know, and so you began even at an extremely young age to cover up, to hide, to what's called compartmentalize, to push away this pain from yourself. And by now, it's kind of like, you know, nobody gets in their car and has to think about, now, how do I turn this on? You know, what used to be very conscious becomes unconscious. And so that is what has happened. And what those people will tell me is that they kind of know something's wrong, but their lives look great. And so even they have trouble recognizing that they've created this facade that is the foundation of which is very, very shaky. And because everything looks so great on the first, second, and third floor, but at the bottom, there's just some horrible foundational problems. And so it is understanding that gradually that house is sinking or falling apart. There are cracks in it or something. Because what happens is that what my interviewees told me is that the loneliness and despair of just not feeling known and not being able to experience all of your emotions is just so, you can become so desperate that you actually do think about dying by suicide all the time. Or maybe you're not that dramatic, but maybe you just wish you weren't here, or, you know, that, and you just feel incredibly lonely. So those are the people, and I think you can sort of have a mixture. Some things you can sort of know and some things you can't. But, you know, I will tell you that every person that I have seen that has come into my office and said, I read this or I heard you talking about this and this is who I am, they don't look depressed at all. I mean, their businesses are thriving, they're in pageants, they're surgeons, they're really good lawyers, they're, you know, they're buttoned up, spiffed up, you know, these people have got it going on, as they would say, and yet underneath all that is a really, really shaky child who just needs soothing, and they don't know how to do it.
That's amazing. That really is. It's amazing what we can do with our emotions.
Well, yeah, you know, I've had some criticism, frankly, Randy, from people who are saying, now, wait a minute. Isn't that what we're supposed to do? You know, are we supposed to make lemonade out of lemons? I mean, come on.
Oh,
you know,
gosh.
You're calling strength, you're calling endurance, you're calling persistence, you're calling courage illness. No, I'm not.
No, you're not. Absolutely not. I mean, I totally get what you're saying. And I can recognize that. You know, I can think of several people that I know who are doing that, and you just know that something is just not right. You talked about the compartmentalization. And So in your book, you say that healthy coping involves the compartmentalization of feelings, but this is when you store them away in a closet for a brief time until you have time or are ready to look at them. And then you experience
Correct.
Them, right, when it's safe and, you know, you have privacy or whatever. You connect, whether they're good or bad, and you relate it to a tree that either can bend in the wind or can't and breaks.
Right.
So
right.
I wanted to talk about the coping mechanisms, because so many of us did not develop healthy ones in childhood, and we take whatever maladaptive coping mechanisms we've developed into our adult life, and they don't work.
You
bet. We don't know why. Yep. And
mm-hmm.
we don't know
mm-hmm.
why. So for someone who has maladaptive coping mechanisms that are causing problems for them, what is the best way for them to start turning that around, to start opening that up and changing a different way to connect with their emotions and accept them?
Sure, sure. Well, they first have to recognize it's maladaptive.
Okay.
And that is a huge step in and of itself. I'll give you an example from my own life. I had a very overprotective mother. I mean, we were highly enmeshed, which means for your listeners, that just means that I knew too much about her life and she knew too much about mine. And we were involved in each other's lives very tightly, and it wasn't healthy for either one of us. And she was the parent, and so she created it. I didn't create it, but it took me a while to figure out. Okay, enough about me. But what the point is that my strategy in order to handle that was to do things without her knowledge and then sort of ask for forgiveness, you know, afterwards. It was kind of, I'm going to sign up for this and she's not going to know, because she wanted to keep me very limited in my activities. Well, as an adult, that strategy turned into never saying no. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just sort of with abandon, not using good judgment about what was good self-care and what was way over the top and when was I jumping into the deep end and didn't realize it, didn't have the skills to handle it. So, you know, that strategy may have been incredibly adaptive as a child. You know, it helped me have more of a life than my mother wanted me to have or seemed to be able to let me have. But so I compensated for that, but then that compensation led me into some problems in my adulthood. To me, Randy, this is the way you tell. You can catch yourself when you have an overreaction to something or an underreaction to something. For example, I'll use myself again. My husband will sometimes say, "Do you need help with that?" That seems like a fairly innocuous question, right? I mean, he's just asking me if I need help. And sometimes I'll go, no. Meaning that I am sensitive to someone, to feelings. I will perceive feeling smothered when I'm not being smothered at all because of my early childhood experience. So I'm a very independent person, but I can carry independence too far. So What I try to help my patients look for is when they are overreacting to something or underreacting. If you were screamed at as a child, if you were highly ridiculed as a child, then you might get into a relationship where you're also criticized unduly, and it's just familiar, and so you underreact to something. That is a key to the fact that your strategy that you're using is no longer working for you. Because anybody else, if you put anybody else in that boat that you're in, they would go, "What? You can't talk to me that way." Or, "Why are you getting mad at your husband? He's just being nice." You know? So we have these emotional responses to things that are huge clues to us about when our strategies are really getting in our way and helping us live life more fully rather than, you know, making life more difficult for us.
Okay, that was a really good explanation. So, in order to, I would say, based on all that, in order to develop healthy coping mechanisms that will carry us through life in a emotionally, mentally healthy way, that's really about experiencing emotions and accepting them. Is it not?
Mm-hmm. Yes, and of course, some people will tell you, "I don't want to experience my emotions. I don't trust them. I think they're. I want to stay in my logical self." And to me, the far healthier thing is to say, "Well, I want to marry my logic with my emotional intelligence. Mm. I want to use both. I want to use the part of me that can think through things. I don't want my emotions to overwhelm that. I want to stay rational and logical, but I also want my emotions to be able to help me see perhaps more subtle things that are also important, or that might guide good decision making as well. Sometimes when you're afraid of something, there's a reason you're afraid of it. When your alarm, you know, your alarm bell goes off, your gut saying something's wrong here, something is wrong there. That's not your logic. That's your gut.
That's right.
Instinct.
And that is always
and so,
true. That's always right.
Right.
Did I interrupt?
Yeah, a little bit. That's okay. That's perfectly all right. I was thinking if I would say it was always. I hesitate using the word always because I just don't know if anything's always true. I mean, my gut could tell me that spider crawling over there is going to ruin my day. And if I'm irrational enough, or it's going to bite me and I'm going to die because my gut is ill-informed. but sometimes if it's, the right kind of spider, I should be afraid. So sometimes our minds can get a little irrational, or more than a little. So I think what we're trying to talk about is how do we, when you're not accustomed to connecting with your emotions, how do you do that? And it is a very gradual learning process, because I'll never forget a guy. I ended up being very fond of this man. He worked with me for about 2 years, and he came in one time and said, "I really don't know what all this talking about feelings is all about. I mean, why do I have to talk to my wife about my feelings?" I just went, "Okay, I see kind of where we are here." And because he had no training as a child. He grew up in one of those families where they said, we don't talk about being angry. That's not appropriate. We don't talk about being afraid. That's not appropriate. And he was Mr. Everything in high school, and he did what he was supposed to do, and that's what he'd done all his life. And he was one really angry guy. And so, what was he doing but having affairs and breaking the rules, right? And then he got suicidal. So he had to learn that there was benefit to feelings, and that he could risk beginning to feel them. He could risk that vulnerability that Brené Brown talks a lot about. I don't know if you've watched the Netflix series that she did, or it's not a series, it's just a show. It was incredible. And, there's a lot of, sometimes, especially with men, and unfortunately, I don't know, it's a gender stereotype, but they still exist, sadly. And there was a soldier that got up. He was still in uniform, I believe, maybe just described himself as being he'd done 3 tours in Afghanistan. And he looked at her and he said, "You're exactly right. Every time I went into that battlefield, I was scared. I knew that I was vulnerable. I knew I could not get, I still went, but I had to go through my vulnerability first." You find your courage by going through your vulnerability. And that's why I say that talking about this stuff is not about, I want people to feel strong. I want people to feel competent. I want people, but I also want them to take stock of their fear. And so, and their anger and their pain, I want them to have compassion for themselves, to learn how. And many people need to learn how to do that. They will discount, especially people I'm trying to talk to. They will say, "Oh, that wasn't all that important. I know somebody who had it a lot worse off than me." Sure, you could always find somebody who has it worse off than you. Always. But it is about carrying that sense of personal compassion and understanding that you went through some things that were very hard for you, and you learned how to manage those things. I mean, you already shared you had a narcissistic mother. I'm sure that was extremely, extremely difficult. and somehow you've turned that into, you know, a strategy or a lifestyle where you're trying to recognize your own strengths and come away from that. But, you know, if you don't have the compassion for the child that went through it, then that can be a problem. And compartmentalization is a healthy thing. You know, I knew I had this interview today, and let's say this is a first world problem, but let's say I didn't have any hot water this morning. And so, you know, I'm in a grumpy mood because I didn't have any hot water this morning. Well, I've got to compartmentalize that, you know, and so that I can focus on this interview with you. I may feel kind of grungy, I may whatever, but compartmentalization is how we handle life. It's bad things happen, disappointments happen. You find out you didn't get the raise. You find out that, you know, people are going to get laid off. Your best friend is moving out of town. Your grandmother died. Your husband's having a divorce. I mean, having an affair. Whatever it is, you know, obviously we have to function in life and we have to compartmentalize these things. People with perfectionism and perfectly hidden depression rigidly compartmentalize it. They don't only stuff it in the closet, they close the closet, lock the closet, and don't ever go in the closet.
Amazing. What's the difference
and pretend
between...
the closet doesn't exist.
Doesn't exist, right. They put wallpaper over the door so you don't even see it, or put a furniture in front of it.
That's right.
So how do you tell if you're perfectionistic? What's the difference between being perfectionistic, being someone who strives for excellence, or having the syndrome, or being OCD? I mean, there's different so many different ways that people express perfectionism. So, how do we distinguish that it's being caused by depression?
Sure. I think that wanting something to be really, really good. I mean, I have struggled with perfectionism all my life. My mother was a perfectionist, and I learned that from her. And I remember even telling a therapist one time. She asked me the question, "What would happen if you took the thumb out of your back?" And I looked at her. The first thing I could think of was, "I would turn into a slug." Is what I told her. So, it is that. It's when perfectionism is fueled or governed by shame. I think in OCD, perfectionism or needing things to be orderly and organized is because your anxiety is so high. You know, it calms you down for your pillows to be placed just such a way. It calms you down to have, you know, order and organization, and your spices are alphabetized and all that stuff. Your underwear is folded. It's about anxiety. The kind of people I'm talking about, their perfectionism there's a shameful voice that is saying, you better do this the best you can all the time, all your life, or people won't love you anymore. You will have no value. You know, I know who you are underneath, and you're not who people think you are, so you better do this well and keep on hiding. Now, I will say that research has shown, and there's some wonderful research on perfectionism going on in Canada by Drs. Gordon Flett, Paul Hewitt, or two of them. Those two were kind enough to talk to me. And the research has indicated that there are really three different types of perfectionism. There's self-oriented perfectionism, which is the kind of like striving for excellence. You know, I want to try to be perfect. I'm very driven. I'm just a competitive, driven person. There is other-oriented perfectionism, which means I expect perfectionism of others. But the third is called socially prescribed perfectionism. And in the intro, you talked a lot about social media. And I think social media has really exaggerated this socially prescribed perfectionism, where the point of that is that you never get off the treadmill of having to be better than you were last time. You're constantly feeding this need to do better, need to do, you know, somebody slaps you on the back and says, wow, you know, you did a fantastic job with that pie you baked or that presentation you made or that, you know, the project you helped your kid with or the party you threw or whatever. And then they say, can't wait for the next one. And what a socially prescribed perfectionist will take that as, they will take that like, I've got to make it better than the next one. And it's there's so much pressure. And so it's not as much based on anxiety as it is on fear. Fear that I'm getting more clear about this as I talk. I didn't put this in the
book. Isn't that amazing? I'm getting all kinds of lights going off.
It's more based on fear that if I don't do this, tragic things will happen. Bad things will happen.
Right.
And I will be seen as worthless. And my dad was right to throw rocks at me and tell me I would be nothing. It's like, that's why you can hear the part that then it's important to go back and say, well, where did I learn this shame? Where did I pick up this shame from that I had to always be the one with my hand up in the air and always have time for everybody and, you know, and be so unaware and stay and make choices that keep me unaware of what my own feelings are.
Truly amazing. Truly amazing. So let's switch it up and get into a little bit about the change that happens when we do this. And you said there's five C's in the healing process: consciousness, commitment, confrontation, connection, and change. So when we get through this healing process, let's talk about the change aspect of it, because risking change is it's like having the floor dropped out from under you. So what does it feel like when, you know, but what happens when people do risk change for the first time and see what it's like on the other side?
Oh, goodness. Well, I'm thinking about a woman I worked with a couple of years ago, and she had learned that it was not okay to ever express anger. And so she didn't express it overtly, but she did covertly. She would just kind of make these proclamations in her family and just say, well, this is the way it's going to be. And everybody was sort of okay. And I remember when we were working together and she began to recognize something as abuse in her past. She had had a relationship with a man much earlier in her life, and he had been very abusive to her, and she had never connected it with some of the problems she was having in her marriage. And she became so angry at him, at herself, at her family, because she grew up in one of those families that you can't talk about anything. And she looked at me and she said, when will I stop being angry? And I said, I don't know, but you've had it bottled up for a long time. It's been affecting you in ways that you didn't realize, and now you're beginning to realize how it's affecting you, and you can see it, making the unconscious conscious, as Freud would say. And she didn't stay angry forever, but she did have to start talking about her anger. Her husband's response was really wonderful, and that's not always the case, but her husband's response was, I've known you were angry, I just haven't known what you were angry about. So many of these people keep so much of themselves hidden, that their partners can guess that there's something underneath that, you know, never looked like your tired facade. But it was so uncomfortable for her, and she felt as if she was cracking open, you know, that she could experience her anger in the moment, and it, you know, nothing horrible happened. But it was very, you know, we've all watched our children take their first steps. They're, you know, they don't stride forward. You know, they're little baby steps. And so we have to do the same things emotionally, because we're not good at this. We're not good at admitting that, you know, we're scared or angry or disappointed or just embarrassed or whatever. So it is kind of like creating a new skin for yourself. But it also can be so freeing, because the rules you were living by were so constrictive that you know, days begin to just seem like the same thing, rote, you know, your days can be governed by these rules that demand that you do this and you do this and you do it this way. And when you really stop to question, well, why? You know, why? Maybe this doesn't really work for me anymore. What would work for me? What if I don't do it perfectly? What if I don't even do it as well as I could? Sometimes I will give people the assignment to go out and purposefully do something mediocre. Just do it in a mediocre way and have fun with it. Or if you say, I can never say the words, I've been abused, then go into your, I don't know, if you live in New York, go on to, you know, go on to Wall Street or in Times Square and just say the words, I was sexually abused. You know, or just say them.
Yeah.
Hear yourself say them. There are things that you can do that you don't think you can do. And that if you begin to push your behavior, I'm a firm believer, Randy, that we don't get our hope from inside. I've been a therapist for over 25 years, and I've seen a lot of people gain a lot of insight. Oh, now I understand why that happened and why that happened and how those things are connected. And that's wonderful. And that's a great underpinning for putting the pieces together and for seeing the picture as a whole. However, where you get hope is when your behavior changes. When you have always yelled at your kid about something, and then all of a sudden you go, wait a minute, I don't need to yell about that. You know, or you've always not said anything when someone has been rude to you, and all of a sudden you go, you know, I really don't want you to talk to me that way. Mm-hmm. You know, when your behavior changes, then you feel so differently.
It's empowering.
It's very empowering. Very empowering.
Yeah, yeah. You know, my experience working with my clients are that so many of them don't understand that they have the permission to be who they are. And it's similar in a way, you know. And when I tell them, you're perfectly fine with who you are, you don't, you know, they measure themselves against everybody. And
mm-hmm.
when I say, you know, and a lot of them have dropped the careers that they've been in because they realize
mm-hmm.
that's just not me, you know. But it's,
mm-hmm.
But people often need permission to do that, to drop that and just
well,
be who
they are.
Well, they're
following these rules, right. They're following some kind of rules. It's very cognitive behavioral therapy to go back and look at both the rules you're following, but you need to, you know, appreciate them for what they were in the past. Maybe they kept you safe. Maybe they helped you survive. Maybe they helped you conform to whatever family or culture or, what you know, nationality or whatever that you found yourself in. But they don't necessarily have to live your, you know,
run your life
govern
now,
your life
right?
Now. Right.
Absolutely.
I have a patient who grew up in a rural Arkansas community, and he's gay, and he knew he was gay, but he tried very hard. He did everything he could to not express being gay, to the point where, you know, he overdid it. I mean, he looks, you know, macho kind of thing. And he has struggled all his life to let go of that rule and to come into who he is. Now, that's a more dramatic example, but there's plenty of people who, you know, hide who they really are because of fear or condemnation or whatever. And it is, it's, you know, you can, gosh, I mean, I grew up, I mean, my parents sent me to college so that I could find a man to marry, you know, practically. And so, you know, I finally, my mother said, but you're not marrying a doctor. I said, no, I'll just become one. So, how about that? But if I was still, you know, I think when I married the first time, I did, okay, I got to get married. So, you know, it's those rules are, you know, you can decide the ones that you want to follow and the ones that no longer apply.
Yeah, you know, I was watching, there's a new Netflix series, short series, about Aaron Hernandez, the football player who murdered his friend. Yeah, but what's interesting about it is that he was gay. Nobody knew it. And yes, and they talk about his father was very macho, and his friend who had a relationship with him when they were in high school but masked it, talks about, you know, the relationship that they had and everything like that. And it was trying, he was trying to be someone he was not, you know, and in the end he killed himself in, he was found dead in his cell in prison. So I found that really unusual. I didn't, you know, that's not something that the media emphasized, but it's really interesting to watch it. It's very interesting to watch it.
I'll watch it myself.
Yeah. So last, we just have a few minutes. Okay. What is it like when we allow people to know us, when we never have allowed them to know us before? That's scary,
scary,
you know? That's scary, right?
Yeah. I mean, I'm blessed to have a few friends who know the real me and know what I struggle with. And sometimes our conversation, sometimes I welcome them and sometimes they go, I'm not sure I'm ready for this. But it, you know, I have panic disorder, Randy, and I developed it in my late 20s, and it's performance anxiety mostly, which I was a professional singer at the time, and so that was devastating to my career.
Oh, my gosh.
So, but anyway, it was, I never told anybody. I mean, it was a secret. I was so embarrassed. I thought it was shameful. Talk about stigma. I mean, this was long before I thought about becoming a psychologist. And so, and I remember the first therapist I went to that said, I'm not going to help you get rid of these. I'm going to help you manage them and accept them. And I looked at him and said, well, I don't know if I want that. And he said, well, yeah, that's what I'm offering. And that was really my first step toward realizing that your vulnerabilities, you may not like them, but they are as interwoven in who you are and why you are who you are as your strengths and competencies. And they don't define you in any greater way. We just think they do. And the people that are... And the people that are most competent know and are truly, you know, like that bending tree you talked about a few minutes ago that I talked about in the book, that can bend and are not going to break, know their vulnerabilities, accept them, and work with them instead of trying to hide them from the world.
Wow, that's great. That's a great way to end the show, because... Yeah, when you know who you are, then it doesn't matter what people say to you. It doesn't matter what you experience. You know authentically who you are, and you've accepted it, you've embraced it, you know. So I think that's really the bottom line of all of this, is to really accept and know who you are. And then all these other things, you know, we all have quirks. We all do. Everybody has quirks.
Sure.
And we all think we're weird for having them. But everybody has them, you know. So we look at other people, and especially, you know, I could get into this for another hour about the Facebook thing, but so many people size themselves up against what they see on Facebook. I personally cannot go on my personal Facebook page because it upsets and depresses me. It makes me feel as if my life is not good, and my life is wonderful, you know. So I have to not go on that because I don't want that feeling. I don't want to feel like that. So, but anyway, this is so we're talking. We talked about your book, Perfectly Hidden Depression: How to Break Free from the Perfectionism That Masks Your Depression. And this book is available where?
It's available at on Amazon, Barnes and Noble, your indie bookseller, your private bookseller there in your hometown or wherever. They may not have it on their shelves, but they can certainly order it. It's available in ebook form as well. So. If you don't want to march into the store and buy a book on Perfectly Hidden Depression, then you can get it through ebook as well.
Okay, perfect. And you mentioned your website
and
in the very beginning.
Yeah,
would you
right.
say that again? Yeah.
Yeah, sure. My website is drmargaretrutherford.com, and then the website for the book is perfectlyhiddendepression.com, and I do have a podcast myself called the Self-Work Podcast. With Dr. Margaret Rutherford, and it's everywhere, iTunes, Spotify, iHeartRadio, everything. It's called the Self-Work Podcast.
Oh, wow. Well, I'd like to be on that, so maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe you'll invite me.
Well, I don't have guests right now. I incorporated some guests, and I got some feedback that people feel like they're using it more like it's a therapy session for them, and it feels like somebody's sort of all of a sudden in their therapy session. And I am looking into, I'm working with some people about, do I want to do an interview thing that would be separate from that. So I'll keep you in mind for sure.
Yeah, maybe. Let me know. Because I have a lot to say about that. Anyway, it's been my pleasure. Absolutely wonderful having you. And thank you for bringing this perfectly hidden depression subject to light for all of us so we can be better, you know, we can feel better, live better lives, feel free, you know, feel free from all these burdens. So thank you. I so appreciate you being my guest today.
Thank you, Randy. I'm delighted.
Okay. All right. Well, take care and have a great day.
Okay. You too.
Okay, bye-bye. We are out of time, but if you have any comments or questions about today's show, you can email me at loveyourlife@randyfine.com. May joy and serenity always be yours. Goodbye.